Welcome back to the program. 40-plus years ago in Vietnam, we saw how the best and the brightest could ignore history, ignore truth and facts, and conducted one of our nation's most disastrous wars. 10 years ago this month, we saw how lies, inept personnel, and poor and corrupt execution destroyed any hope of success in Iraq, decisions that still plague us today. 4 years ago, back in 2009, we thought that the Obama administration was fighting the good war in Afghanistan when we decided to surge U.S. troops and civilians. Yet again, we ignored history, didn't send the best personnel, engaged in bureaucratic infighting, and thought money could buy our way out. It did not. Why do we keep making these same mistakes? Is, in fact, the fault not in our stars, but in ourselves? These are the issues examined by esteemed and award-winning journalist Rajiv Chandrasekharan in his book Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. Chandrasekharan is a senior correspondent and associate editor of the Washington Post. He's been the newspaper's bureau chief in Baghdad, Cairo, and Southeast Asia, and has been covering Afghanistan for a decade. His book, Imperial Life in the Emerald City, won the Overseas Press Club Book Award and is perhaps the most important book written about our failure in Iraq. It is my pleasure to welcome Rajiv Chandrasekharan back to this program to talk about Little America, the war within the war for Afghanistan. Rajiv Chandrasekharan, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a real pleasure to join you again.
Great to have you here. We seem to keep making this same mistake over and over again. We want to fix things. We want to make everything right in the world, and yet we never seem to get the execution right, no matter how good the intent might be.
This is true. And, you know, as I've now witnessed these two failed reconstruction efforts, these two failed wars in Iraq and Afghanistan up close, I come away incredibly torn. You know, on one hand, a lot of what I've seen has led me to conclude that we Americans should simply get out of the nation-building business. We're not very good at it. Leave it to other people to rebuild their societies on their own time frames, and we should focus on the challenges we face domestically. But on the other hand, I look at our country of 300-plus million people, and I think to myself, boy, we have a lot of talented people here. We've got people with the necessary language skills, people who are willing to take the risks to go out to these far-off lands, people who want to help, people who possess the expertise in local government and in helping to provide some basic economic development to these very needy and well-deserving societies. But why haven't those people been brought to the fore? You know, in Iraq, I wrote about how the Bush administration employed a political litmus test for people to go out there in the early years of the war. You know, they asked people absurd questions like whether they believed in Roe versus Wade and capital punishment before they were allowed to head out to Baghdad. Now, when Team Obama came to Afghanistan, it was different, obviously. They decided to put the pros in charge, people from the State Department, from the U.S. Agency for International Development, and other experts. But, you know, the bureaucracy still fails us, and those responsible for doing the hiring to get people out to these places, to get people out to Afghanistan in particular, simply waited for, you know, resumes to come in over the transom instead of aggressively searching our country for the best talent for these sorts of jobs. So in a very different way in Afghanistan, we've mucked up the nation building just like we did in Iraq.
The other aspect is that we never seem to learn from the history of these places. You talk about the history and particularly the history of southern Afghanistan and some of the things that went on there historically and how we've messed up nation building in the past, even trying to fix the agricultural landscape for that part of the country many, many years ago.
You know, most Americans think our engagement in Afghanistan began with the September 11th attacks, or perhaps in the 1980s when the Soviets invaded. But what I discovered in writing this book, Little America, was that the American involvement in Afghanistan, particularly in southern Afghanistan where our troops are fighting today, began in the late 1940s. It was part of a grand post-World War II development effort, at that point paid for by the Afghans, to dig irrigation canals, to put in dams and other sorts of things. They wanted to turn the Helmand River Valley into a mini version of the Imperial Valley in California. And they thought that they could harness the waters of the Helmand River and create these lush farmlands, the likes of which we have in California. And, of course, that project was essentially doomed from the start. The proper analysis wasn't done to examine the quality of the soil, but more fundamentally, there just wasn't the requisite communication between the Americans and the Afghans, and the American officials thought that because they were speaking to suit-wearing, English-speaking, American-educated Afghans in the capital, they were somehow speaking to the entire country, and it turned out that the people in the South couldn't be more different than the people in the capital, and they didn't really share the same connection to this project. You know, if you go back and you change the dates and the names, you could be writing about today. And that's why I open the book with the story of this American venture. And in fact, they built a town for themselves, the American engineers, and they thought the Afghans would seek to emulate for themselves to live in a more civilized society as they saw it. It was an 8-square-block town with suburban-style white stucco bungalows with manicured green front lawns, the country's first and only co-ed high school, a swimming pool where boys and girls would swim together, a clubhouse where they played nightly card games and you could drink a gin and tonic. And the Americans thought the Afghans would seek to build towns like this for themselves. They, of course, had no desire to do so, but they did come up with a name for this model community. The Afghans called it Little America, and that's where I get the title of the book from. And in some ways, it's really a metaphor for our overall failure to grasp history, to understand that we've been through this bad movie once before, and had policymakers in Washington bothered to engage with any of this history, perhaps they might have been more modest in their grand nation-building efforts over the past decade.
And one of the ironies is, by the time we figured that problem out, by the time Kissinger sent the right people in to figure out a solution, it was too late. The Russian invasion was coming along, not unlike what has gone on contemporaneously in Afghanistan, where by the time we kind of sort of got it right, it was too late.
Totally right. You know, now we're actually on a path that is more defensible. We're reducing our troop footprint there. We're reducing the amount of money we're pumping into the country. We're putting Afghans into the lead for security, for the governance of their country. That's something we should have done a long time ago. It doesn't mean we should abandon Afghanistan overnight, but our presence needs to be far more modest and far more sustainable. And, you know, had we taken a different approach back in the 1950s and 60s, we might have accomplished something more before the clock ran out. And I fear that the same story is going to replay itself, whereby we've spent a lot of blood and treasure there. We have accomplished some things, even though it looks so bleak in the headlines. There are more children going to school. The condition of people around the country has improved. The Afghan security forces, as raggedy as they are stepping up to shoulder more of the burden. It's not perfect, not by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, with a very modest commitment, we could give them at least a fighting chance of at least holding on to the capital and other major cities. But are we just now too tired? Because, you know, was the surge a sprint? And what Afghanistan really needed was a marathon. And did we just wind ourselves far too quickly?
The other side of that same coin is, had we engaged in this same counterinsurgency strategy back in 2001, 2002, 2003, it might have had a very different impact as well.
Oh, totally. I mean, look, we took our eyes off the ball in Afghanistan when progress was far more easily achievable to go and invade Iraq. Had we not gone off on that fool's errand in Iraq and focused on Afghanistan, we wouldn't be having this discussion today. Now, Afghanistan wouldn't be perfect. There'd still be corruption. There'd probably still be a small insurgency. But it would be nothing on the magnitude that we're seeing today. And we'd have lost the lives of far fewer Americans, and far fewer Afghans would be dead as well. You know, Iraq is directly connected to Afghanistan.
The other overlay to all this is, in addition to ignoring history, in addition to sending the wrong people, and in addition to waiting too long, the bureaucratic infighting that went on, even within the Obama administration in 2009, added to so many of the problems.
You know, it pains me to say this, but you know, you're absolutely right. And the worst fight, and this is why the subtitle of the book is the war within the war for Afghanistan, because I discovered that there wasn't just a war going on in the deserts of southern Afghanistan that I was covering when I was out there, but there was a second war happening inside the Beltway. And one of the nastiest battles was between the State Department and the White House over the issue of the possibility of peace talks with the Taliban. And this fight had nothing to do with substance. Both the State Department and the White House supported the idea of trying to get the Taliban to the negotiating table, reasoning that you weren't going to kill every last single one of them, and the only way to get to a reasonable outcome here was through a negotiated settlement. The problem was in personalities. Hillary Clinton, then Secretary of State, appointed her old friend Richard Holbrooke to lead that effort at the State Department. Now, Holbrooke was eminently qualified. He'd been the youngest American to serve on the U.S. delegation to the Paris peace talks to try to end the Vietnam War. In 1996, he almost single-handedly brokered the Dayton Accords to end the Civil War in the Balkans. So he was eminently talented. He had more experience with war and peace than anybody else at top levels of the Obama administration, but he also had a giant ego. He had a flair for the dramatic, and it didn't go down so well in a White House run by a president nicknamed No Drama Obama. And so key members of Obama's national security team essentially sought to box out Holbrooke, and it got very petty. They disallowed him the use of government aircraft to travel to the region. They scheduled key meetings when he was out of town. They sought to undercut him in front of the leaders of Afghanistan and Pakistan, and this really squandered the leverage that we had with additional troops going into the country to try to get to some sort of peace deal.
It was also this very ironic situation that seemed to play out where the whole idea of going over there in the first place, the whole idea of the surge, was inherently risky. And yet once the administration committed to the strategy, it seemed that they didn't want to take risks. They wanted it both ways.
Well, I think this speaks to the president's fundamental unease with the overall surge, and that he felt that he was boxed in by his commanders. You know, back in the summer of 2009, when General Stan McChrystal asked for more troops, and as a result, a series of strategy discussions were held in the White House, the military leadership essentially told the president, it was a version of the old Henry Ford line about the color of your car, that you can have any color you want so long as it's black. The military leadership told the president that, look, the only strategy here that will work is counterinsurgency, and the only way to do that is with many more troops. They did not meaningfully look at alternate approaches, and this really really frustrated and angered senior officials in the White House, not just the president, but Vice President Biden and others, that the military wasn't willing to look more seriously at what you could do with a smaller number of troops. And I think that this then manifests itself in the president's decision to both order the surge, but to place a very important caveat on it, which is that those surge troops would have to start coming home within 2 years of their deployment, which was Obama's way of saying this will not be an open-ended commitment, in part because he worried that the military's promises were just too rosy.
You mentioned Vice President Biden before. He was really the chief skeptic in this whole enterprise, even when it was 17,000 troops that were being talked about from the beginning. And you talk about a memo that he wrote privately to the president.
Yes, and it's a fascinating memo where he is very prescient, lays out the key arguments against a troop surge and questions the sincerity of the Pakistani government to follow through on cracking down on Taliban sanctuaries on its own soil, the willingness of President Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan to be a legitimate partner with the United States in pursuing the counterinsurgency strategy, and other issues. And it turns out that Biden was right all along.
Talk a little bit about the pressure that the military, that McChrystal and Petraeus and Admiral Mullen were putting on the administration when they determined that they wanted 40,000 troops, not 17,000.
Well, you know, it was a full court press. There were the Admiral Mike Mullen, then the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dave Petraeus, then head of CENTCOM, and General McChrystal, who was the top commander in COPPL, all sort of were in lockstep on this. And there was a remarkable development in civil-military relations in our country. You know, the way our system is supposed to work is that military commanders provide their best advice and then let the civilians hash it out and form the policy. Here, what you had was the commanders essentially serving as lobbyists for the surge. They were the principal advocates, and it turned into essentially the civilians versus the military. It was a very odd position, and one that was a result of former Defense Secretary Bob Gates, who everybody in Washington seems to love, and I think he was a great Secretary of Defense, but he sort of hung back. Instead of saying to his commanders, thank you for that, now I'm going to argue either on behalf of you or come up with my own plan, he essentially pushed them out front to do the arguing, and he hung back. That's not the way it's supposed to work.
One of the things that we did do, particularly that you talk about in 2010, is when things weren't going well, we just kept throwing money at the problem to the tune of $4 or $5 billion.
A year. Just for reconstruction. You know, that's far more than the country can reasonably absorb. You know, look, Afghanistan has real needs. It was starved of assistance during the Bush administration. You know, rates of infant mortality, illiteracy, malnutrition, they're all off the charts. It needs help. You know, Afghanistan, think of the country as sort of a really parched man on a hot summer day. You know, what he needed was a tall glass of ice water. But instead of doing that, with the best of intentions, we turned a fire hose on him, far more than he could reasonably drink, and wound up hurting him in the process. You know, in some parts of southern Afghanistan, we were pumping in more money than the per capita income of every man, woman, and child in the area, which was fundamentally distorting the economy, and it was fueling the very corruption we were trying to stop.
It was fueling the corruption, and the combination of the money and the surge also made the Afghan military lazier. It acted as a greater crutch, as you talk about, and went counter to what we were trying to accomplish.
We were trying to build up this army, but by pushing in so many resources and so many troops, in many cases the Afghans simply hung back and said, all right, you guys do the fighting. Well, why should we put our necks on the line? You know, that's changing now, that we're bringing troops home and we're forcing the Afghans to take more responsibility. You know, could we have forced the Afghans to take in more responsibility sooner? And I think the record will show yes, and that our presence there in some places was simply too large, and it crowded out Afghan initiative.
Talk a little bit about the journalists that were there and the role that they played and the role that they might have played.
Well, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of coverage of this war, in part because, a lot of financial pressures on the news business. There are just fewer reporters out covering these things compared to the early days of the war in Afghanistan or the early days of the war in Iraq. So it's just much harder for people to learn about what's going on there. But you know, the American public's also gotten tired. You know, I commend you for taking the time to talk about this, but there are a lot of people out there who just don't want to talk about the war. And one of the things I'm trying to do is open people's eyes to what's happened there in an apolitical way. I'm not trying to argue that, we should get out entirely or we should, stay the course with no troop reductions. I think that it's important for people just to understand the consequences of what was done, and to think about the future over there, because like it or not, we're not going to be able to walk away entirely. Afghanistan and that region is going to need our help. It's still one of the most dangerous parts of the world. Next door, Pakistan has nuclear weapons. Afghanistan also abuts Iran. There are real reasons for the U.S. to have some involvement and engagement there. But what should that be? How big? How much money should we help provide them in aid once our most of our troops start coming home. These are important issues for the American people to talk about. And sadly, our political leadership doesn't spend much time talking about it. Our Congress doesn't think much about it. And there isn't much in the media. So I feel like I'm sort of rowing, you know, against a really strong tide. But I feel strongly that people do need to understand this. We still have 60,000 men and women in uniform serving there. We still have thousands of American civilians there as diplomats, as aid workers, as contractors. There's still an American commitment, like it or not, and the rest of us should at least pay some attention to it.
And coming back to the point where we started, there's also the historical issue, the fact that we never seem to learn from these experiences, whether it was Vietnam, whether it was the mistakes in Iraq or the mistakes in Afghanistan, all different administrations, different political parties, but the same mistakes.
We Americans tend to think that history doesn't apply to us, that what was done in the past won't repeat itself because we're now smarter. We have more resources. We're approaching it differently. We look to, for instance, in Afghanistan, the years that the British were there fighting wars and say, that's never going to be us. We look at the Soviet invasion in the 80s and we say, the Soviets were inept. We're doing this better. And you know what? We are doing it better. But there are still enduring lessons there from history. And you know, as they say, it's become so cliched, you know, those who don't bother to learn it are bound to repeat it. And I feel like with so many aspects of our engagement there, we've ignored the history of foreign powers in Afghanistan. And so we, unfortunately, are repeating some of those mistakes that could have been eminently avoidable.
Rajiv Chandrasekharan, his book is Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. It's just out in paperback from Vintage. Rajiv, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
It was a real pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for devoting the time to this subject.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.